From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the June 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. From Warsaw to Hemel Hempstead. The story of the vital contribution of Polish Codebreakers to the cracking of Enigma before World War II has been covered in previous episodes of this podcast. But what happened to those Codebreakers after the invasion of Poland in 1939? In this episode, we follow the long and winding path of the Polish cryptanalysts from Warsaw to London. We also look more widely at the work done by the Polish government in exile in the UK to intercept wireless traffic and collaborate with Bletchley Park on signals intelligence. Joining us is Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon. Grateful thanks, too, to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents. Just to add, while we've made every effort to pronounce Polish names and places properly, neither David nor I are Polish speakers, and so some mispronunciation or anglicisation might occur. In this episode, we're looking particularly at events at the outbreak of war and just beyond. David, can you tell us what happened to the Polish Codebreakers after Nazi Germany invaded Poland in 1939?
The Polish Codebreakers have to evacuate Warsaw fairly hastily because the Polish resistance to both the German invasion and the subsequent Soviet invasion was relatively short-lived. So the Polish Cipher Bureau, the Bureau Szyfrów, which is based in Warsaw, packed up and they evacuated from Poland to France. As we've heard previously, they were already in touch with Gustave Bertrand and the French Cryptographic Service, as well as with GCNCS in the UK. And Bertrand was able to arrange for most of the Polish team to relocate to Paris.
Why particularly France, not Switzerland or Belgium?
The reason they went to France was this tripartite code-breaking relationship between the UK, France and Poland had already been established during the summer of 1939. They'd had two meetings, one in January and one famously in July. And so it made sense for them to go to one of the other two countries that they were already working with and where there were people they already knew. And so Paris was the obvious first port of call, really.
And what were they doing in Paris?
Well, they carried on working. Gustave Bertrand set them up in a place called the Château de Vignoles, which is in a village about 40 kilometres south of Paris. They set up an operation that was called, codenamed Bruno, PC Bruno, which stands for Poste de Commandement in French. Bertrand ran it, but it included 15 Polish codebreakers, 50 French codebreakers, and another 7 anti-fascist Spanish who were exiles because of the Spanish Civil War. And they all worked on both German and Russian, but also Spanish and Italian ciphers at the Château de Vignoles near Paris.
Were they intercepting or code-breaking or both?
Both. They were doing interception and code-breaking. The boss of this organisation was the same man who'd been running the show in Warsaw, which is Guido Langer, who was the lieutenant colonel who had originally been in charge of the second bureau, which was the intelligence code-breaking part of the Polish intelligence service.
So why did they go to Paris and not, say, to the UK?
Well, Stuart Mingies, who was head of SIS, but was also the head of GCNCS, was quite keen for them to come to the UK. But there was a bit of a sort of turf war between him and Colonel Rivet, who was the head of the French intelligence service. And Bertrand wanted to keep the Poles in France, basically. And they made the argument that officially the Polish government had evacuated to France and the surviving parts of the Polish armed forces had moved to France. And the French government was paying all their wages at that point.
Oh, right.
So the French could make a reasonable case to say, we're paying for these guys, all of their colleagues from the other bits of the Polish military are in France, so it makes sense for them to stay in France.
Yeah, they can work for or with us.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, that does make sense.
But they were still working on Enigma, and as we know, in January 1940, we covered in the previous podcast, Alan Turing went to Paris, went to Château de Vignoles, and collaborated on the very first wartime breaks of Enigma with the Poles and with the French. And in due course, Turing took the Zygalski sheets, which the Poles had invented as a method of breaking Enigma, over to Paris and delivered them to the Poles. And then they made some breaks there. And then Turing came back and they carried on breaking in the UK. So it's all quite a smooth collaboration at that point. And for those listeners who've listened to our previous episode, Enigma Unlocked, which is episode 103, if you're looking for it, that's where our story of the Poles kind of finished last time, was with the initial wartime break of Enigma in January 1940.
But then Germany invaded France in May 1940. Everything changed. Is that right?
It did, because, as is quite well known, the German invasion of France was particularly fast and successful, and the French government was forced into an armistice in June of 1940. At that point, Gustave Bertrand and his people in Château de Vignolles had to flee from France, and he evacuated his staff to Algeria.
Not to the UK,
well,
to Algeria.
To Algeria, which was a French colony at the time.
Yeah.
This is part of a much bigger trend. After the French armistice, you see lots of parts of the French armed forces go to North Africa. The French Navy moved from its bases on the Mediterranean coast across to North Africa to get away from the Germans, basically. And there's a whole separate story about how the Royal Navy then went and sank a portion of the French Navy in Mersel Kabir in North Africa to prevent them being captured by the Germans, which the French still haven't forgiven us for. But that's another story. So a lot of different organs of French government were moving to French colonies in North Africa or Syria or elsewhere to try and carry on functioning while metropolitan France was potentially occupied by the Germans. Incidentally, at that point, the British were asked once again and said, can the Polish codebreakers be evacuated to the UK? And Bertrand was still sticking to his guns. He said, no, it's too late. They've all gone to North Africa. They're in Algeria now. It's too late. You can't have them.
Mm-hmm.
So they stayed with Bertrand. And this is the part of the story which sounds really odd, but I guarantee you is correct, which was after the French armistice, the so-called Vichy government in France is established. And France is partitioned into a northern portion, which is under German occupation, includes the Channel ports, the coal country in the north. Southern France is still nominally unoccupied and an independent country, governed from Vichy. It's not an independent country. The Germans have it very much under their thumb. But what this means is Bertrand was able to carry on his code-breaking operations and actually move them back from North Africa to France. And they moved to a place called Uzès near Nice on the Mediterranean coast. And he set up a new code-breaking centre, codenamed Cadix. And there's a rather lovely set of photographs of all the Polish and French codebreakers at Cadix, actually.
Yes.
I think you've seen them.
I've seen them, yes. There's large groups of them stood outside
buildings.
Yeah,
they're all in the garden. It's quite fun. There's one where one of them's got into an enormous plant pot. There's just his head poking out the top. And they carry on doing French and Polish codebreaking work against the Germans and the Russians from Cadix.
That's quite
for the next 2 years.
Perilous situation to be in if, as you say, the Germans have got quite a lot of interest and quite a lot of influence over Vichy France.
It is. And they're kind of flying below the radar. And the British are initially a bit suspicious about this because they don't know to what extent French intelligence are talking to the Vichy government and thus vulnerable to leaks to the Germans. But Bertrand is very keen to carry on collaborating, and they do. They carry on sharing Enigma keys and working away happily in the south of France until late 1942.
When you say sharing Enigma keys, how much material, just a sort of ballpark, were they sharing? Was it huge amounts of material they were working with, or a portion of what they had?
It's not huge amounts. And it becomes apparent that Polish and French work on Enigma kind of declines because by 1942, they're mostly doing German police interception. They don't use Enigma. They use Playfair and other hand ciphers. And so they're involved in that work rather than sort of mainstream Enigma. The other thing you have to remember is, and this will come to this again in a minute, but a lot of the expertise the Poles have brought from Warsaw is in intercepting and breaking Russian traffic, because obviously the Soviet Union invaded Poland, well, shortly after the Germans did. And certainly in the 20s and 30s, the Polish were as much concerned about the threat from the East as they were as the threat from the West. So they had a lot of knowledge and experience of breaking Russian codes. And after the Soviet-Nazi non-aggression pact in 1939, the Russians are on the side of the Germans, effectively, although they're neutral. So until Barbarossa in summer of 1941, the Russians are the enemy, certainly for the Poles and to a certain extent for the British.
Das Oberkommando der Wehrmacht gibt bekannt, der völlige Zusammenbruch der ganzen französischen Front zwischen dem Ärmelkanal und der Maginot-Linie bei Montmédy.
The French resistance has collapsed and the Maginot line has been broken, destroying all French resistance. Paris is an open city.
Paris ist infolgedessen zur offenen Stadt erklärt worden.
I stayed in Paris until late yesterday afternoon and was one of the last three British journalists to leave the capital. But that last day in Paris was unforgettable. It was only the day before that things really began to change, that the war really seemed to have come to Paris. Our hotel let us stay the Tuesday night on the understanding that there would be no service. The next morning, we got up to a city which was a city of the dead. A Paris which no one has ever seen before. Scarcely a single shop was open. But what chiefly struck me, I think, was that two of the great features were missing. There were no newspapers, and scarcely a single cafe was open. Breakfast in the hotel was out of the question. So my two colleagues and I went out in search of somewhere we could get a cup of coffee. After a long search, we found one, and we sat on the deserted terrace outside and ordered our breakfast. After breakfast, I drove round Paris, round all its famous streets. I drove up the Champs-Élysées. It was quite unrecognizable. Scarcely a soul was walking along the pavement. All the cafes were closed. Down the middle, a few belated refugees drove their cars stacked with baggage and household belongings. But at the top, by the unknown soldier's grave under the Arc de Triomphe, the lamp was still burning. And so, later in the afternoon, I left Paris. A sad, deserted Paris, which I never want to see again like that.
We know the Polish codebreakers did come to the UK. How did they get to London?
Well, up to this point, we've been talking about a larger group of Polish codebreakers. And these, of course, include the three famous figures that we know from the Enigma story, who are Marian Rejewski, Jerzy Rozicki, and Henryk Zygalski. Of the three most famous codebreakers, sadly, Jerzy Rozicki was killed in 1942 because the French were operating a codebreaking operation. It's still in Algeria, as well as in south of France. And so people were going back and forth across the Mediterranean to Algeria. And unfortunately, the ship he was on sank in January 1942, and he was killed. So one of the three sort of key Enigma players is lost at that time. The other two, Rejewski and Zygalski, are still in Cadix. However, in November 1942, the Germans occupied the whole of France. They basically abolished the Vichy government and occupied the whole of the southern portion of France. This is contemporaneous with Operation Torch, which is the first Allied amphibious landings in North Africa. Into French North Africa, British and American amphibious invasion. And that is linked to partly why the Germans occupy the rest of France. But anyway, as part of that process, Cadix has to be closed down. And this time, the organized evacuation to North Africa, which they'd done in 1940, isn't an option. It's kind of every man for himself.
So it's escape now rather than evacuation.
It's escape and evasion now. It's literally run for the hills, in this case, the Pyrenees.
Right.
Rejewski and Zygalski were able to cross the Pyrenees into Spain.
You say it's no easy thing to actually do that, though. I presume they were trying to stay undercover and...
Yes, I mean, they don't just sort of walk out of the office and head for the Pyrenees. There's a period when they're moving between safe houses in the south of France and they're in Marseille for a while because they're being assisted by French intelligence and the French resistance. All sorts of people are trying to get out of France at that point.
Mm.
And there are a couple of very well-known routes over the Pyrenees from France into Spain, which were used throughout the war for escaping the Nazis. And some of the routes that downed Allied pilots took, you know, bomber crews and things like that, were over the Pyrenees. But there's a marked path you can follow nowadays. If you're a long-distance walker, you can actually follow one of the famous clandestine paths over the mountains. And there was obviously smuggling and all sorts of things. So not an easy task.
No, but not impossible.
But even if you didn't know where to go, there was a network of French people who could smuggle you over and get you out.
I suppose it's just a different side to the story if you're talking about mathematicians breaking Enigma, but these are also people who are running, you know, fear of their lives and undercover.
And they travel very light because they basically, later in the story, Zygalski was able to go back to France because they'd left all of their heavy luggage in a room in Marseille, I think. I basically just put it all in storage and locked the door and gone in more or less the clothes they stood up in.
My goodness.
To try and escape. As soon as they arrived in Spain, they were arrested. And it took the Spanish police some time to kind of process them and figure out what to do with them. But eventually in May 1943, Rejewski and Zygalski were released from prison. And so, you know, where did they go then? They made their way to Gibraltar and were able to identify themselves as fleeing Poles to the administration in Gibraltar. By that time, they'd hooked up with a couple of other Polish Codebreakers. You worked out the pronunciation of this one, didn't you?
I'm afraid I'm no better, but I shall try Lieutenant Stanislav Shachno, I think. Apologies for our terrible pronunciation. Yes.
And Sylvester Paluch, who was the nephew of the more famous codebreaker, Anthony Paluch, who had also been working at the Bureau of Shifrov in Warsaw. So the four of them make it to the UK. They were flown to Hendon on the 3rd of August, 1943. So those four arrived. They are once again arrested, of course.
This sounds absolutely... They've gone over the Pyrenees. They've been arrested by the Spanish. They've then made it to Gibraltar. They've come to the UK. They've now been arrested again.
Yes, and they were debriefed, I suppose, would be the polite way to put it, by MI5 for a period after their arrival.
Questioned gently.
And once again, they were then handed over to the Polish government in exile in the UK. And we will come to the Polish government in exile in a moment. Up to this point, of course, they have been effectively Polish civil servants. They've been members of the Bureau Shifrov and civilians.
Civilians, yeah.
On arrival in the UK, the first thing that the Polish administration does is enlist them in the Polish armed forces. Rejewski and Zygalski become private soldiers in the Polish army. They're quite quickly promoted to corporal, and we will see later they do get promoted again. But this is the first time they appear in uniform.
Right.
We think of them as military personnel because there are some photographs of them in uniform, but,
yeah, later
but up until this point, they've been civilians.
But you said only four people.
Only four people. Of the other Polish codebreakers who were in Cadix, the fate of some of the others was not as rosy. Guido Langer, who was the boss that we heard about, and Maximilian Czeski were captured by the Germans and were made prisoners of war. Three of the others, Anthony Paluch, who was Sylvester's uncle.
And he set up the course with Czeski that recruited Rejewski, Rozhitsky and Zygalski, I think. Yeah.
Edward Fruszynski and Kazimierz Gacza, they weren't even lucky enough to be prisoners of war. They were actually made civilian slave labourers and sent to Germany. Two of them, Paluch and Fruszynski, died.
They went to Sachsenhausen, I think. All three were sent, and then only Gacza survived of the three, yeah.
And what's remarkable about these individuals, and Langer and Czeski in particular, were interrogated on numerous occasions by German intelligence because they had their suspicions about who these guys were. And they could have just revealed the whole Enigma story because obviously they knew all about Piri, they knew all about the success with Zygalski sheets, they knew the whole thing. I mean, they wouldn't have known about the Turing bomb, but basically they knew Enigma was being broken. And they kept that secret and in some cases took that secret to their grave.
I wish we had time to go more into detail as well. Maybe one day in another episode or other talks, we can go further into this.
They definitely shouldn't be forgotten as part of this story.
We
tend to concentrate on the sort of the famous three, but these other guys, you know, the fact that Enigma was still broken in 1945 successfully without the Germans knowing, you know, these guys can take some of the credit for
Absolutely.
That.
The American invasion force has made landings at Oran and Algiers on the north coast of French North Africa and somewhere on the west coast. These first official details came in a War Department communique released about an hour ago, which listed the generals commanding the American units under Commander-in-Chief Lieutenant General Ike Eisenhower. Among the commands are Brigadier General Jimmy Doolittle for air and one of America's foremost tank experts, Major General George S. Patton, commanding the forces landing on the west coast. An indication that formidable armored units spearhead our attack. The Vichy radio supplied some details of the landings on the west coast. They say that bridgeheads have been established both north and south of Casablanca, at Rabat in the north and at Safi in the south. And from the French reports, it's apparent that landing operations of a major scale are going on. Vichy also confirmed the landings on the north coast at Oran and Algiers. There can be little doubt that our invasion forces are large. An earlier War Department communique made it clear that this operation has been carefully planned over a period of months, and nothing has been left out. Vichy reports already admit that some French troops revolted against the Vichy command, and there were broadcasts over the Casablanca radio reportedly asking Frenchmen to cooperate with the American invasion forces. We also have learned to use the fifth column.
You've taken us up to 1943 and the pretty grim fate of some of the Polish cipher team, but should we go back a little bit? To the Polish government in London, the Polish government in exile, were they involved in signals intelligence too, in addition to what was happening at Cadix?
I described how the Polish government in exile established itself in Paris. After the French armistice, of course, they moved again. They moved to London and they set themselves up in the Rubens Hotel, which is on Buckingham Palace Road, opposite the Royal Mews near Buckingham Palace. It's a very swanky hotel. It's still there.
Still there. Strongly recommend going to dine there, which I've been very lucky enough to do.
I can't claim to have dined there, but if you do, there's a plaque on the front of it, which records the fact that the Polish government was in. It's a very large building, so you could fit a huge number of people in there. The government was led, of course, by Vladislav Sikorsky, who until his death in 1943, basically was everything. He was the prime minister, he was the minister of defense, and he was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So he's the boss. The Polish government in exile set up the various departments it had had when it was the Polish government in Poland. So the Polish General Staff and the second bureau of the Polish General Staff, which is the intelligence department, re-established themselves. And rather confusingly, you have the second bureau, which is responsible for intelligence, and then Department 2 of the second bureau are the people who do code-breaking. They start off doing wireless work in the Rubens Hotel. And there are two strands to Polish wireless operations, which we have to bear in mind. One is clandestine communication with Poland. And there's a lot of time and effort put into supporting the Polish resistance, supporting SOE operations in Poland, all of that kind of thing. We're not really going to talk about that. There's a separate strand, which is enemy wireless interception and code breaking. So there's sort of the two things that, which are intermixed at times and then gradually separate apart. They start off doing this in the Rubens Hotel, but it becomes obvious that doing wire interception in central London is not the best idea. So they apply to the British to get some help. And this obviously passes to Mingy's and to GCNCS. And they say, well, you've got these Polish guys who are doing, again, they're concentrating on Russian traffic. That's their big thing. It says, right, these guys want to move out of the Rubens Hotel. Should we give them some more facilities and accommodation or even move them to Bletchley Park? Because by that point, you know, yeah. Bletchley's up and running.
We get asked this quite often. Like, why weren't the Poles moved directly to Bletchley Park and become part of that on site?
Indeed, we have a memo from John Tiltman, who clearly thought this was the logical thing to do.
It is interesting to hear that there are available in this country Polish WT operators with experience of Russian interception. I cannot understand why we have not been told of them before. These and any other Polish operators with interception experience ought to be made available to us at once. The organisation of a separate station on the small scale suggested in the report would be futile. In the meantime, we are unable to carry out necessary interception of Russian military for lack of trained operators.
It's quite interesting that Tiltman says, I cannot understand why we have not been told of them before. He's like, you know, there's people doing wireless interception. Why didn't we know?
Yeah. Some of whom we met some years ago as well.
Well, he didn't, but Denniston would have.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Denniston says, no, they should be left as an independent organisation and left to do their own thing, although their successes should be exploited by GCNCS, but they shouldn't become part of it. I've not been able to precisely unpick why Denniston took that view, but he did. And so the idea is that they will set the Polish up in their own station and they pick Stanmore initially, because Denniston actually describes, he says it's on the drive from Bletchley to London, so they can sort of, the van can swing by and pick up traffic and everything else.
Stanmore, to regular listeners, is quite a familiar name. It's where one of the largest, I think, bomb out station ended up. But was that around
this
at this time? It's not at all related. They weren't.
Certainly in 41, that bomb out station hasn't been established yet anyway. Mm-hmm. In any case, the Polish were put in a building called Dower House on Stanmore Hill. It was an older sort of posh house there. And they were set up in there with the relevant wireless equipment to do their job.
Did Bletchley Park provide them any additional materials as well, or were they just sort of left?
There's quite a lot of correspondence because you have the Polish government in exile and the Second Bureau, and their liaison officer is a man who Bletchley enthusiasts will have heard of on a number of occasions, Wilfred Dunderdale, known to his friends as Biffy. Biffy Dunderdale had been the liaison officer with Gustave Bertrand and the French, and he, through that connection with the French, he became kind of by default the Polish liaison in the UK. And when the Polish wireless people want something, they talk to Biffy, and Biffy talks to MI6, mm-hmm. and MI6 talk to GCNCS. And so they ended up across a number of buildings in Stanmore, another couple of places called Glenbrain and Herondale. Most of the operations they were doing were clandestine communication with Poland. But within that, you still have this intercept operation going on. They're not actually doing the code breaking at Stanmore. The code breaking is still being done in the Rubens Hotel. So the cryptanalysts are in the Rubens Hotel and the intercept team is at Stanmore. Jump forward a little bit to February 1943, which is getting close to where we left off with Rejewski and Zygalski. By February 1943, they decide that the Y operation, the interception and decryption part of the Polish wireless operation, should be moved away from the clandestine communication section And they are moved to a village called Felden, which in turn is near a slightly larger village called Boxmoor, all of which is now kind of Hemel Hempstead, essentially.
North of London, for North of London, non-British listeners.
On top of a hill, mm-hmm. where you've got good wireless reception. You haven't got too much wireless interference from other things going on. There's a house in Felden, which it's quite confusing. The wartime sources refer to it as the Arches. But if you look in contemporary records, you can't find the Arches. The house was actually called Widgeon's Rest before the war, and is now called Widgeon's. It's something to do with that there was a retired headmaster who bought the house for his retirement, and I think Widgeon was his nickname at school, so he called his house Widgeon's Rest. Again, a big sort of suburban, substantial multi-bedroom house with a big garden. This was taken over. Huts were constructed in the garden of the house itself, and if you look on the air photographs, immediately behind the house is a paddock, and they put wireless masts, interception masts, in that paddock and set up an operation which is christened the Radio Intelligence Company, and these are specifically doing intercept and decryption, and they're placed under the command of one Captain Kazimierz Zielinski.
Do we have any more detail on this Radio Intelligence Company?
We do. It was divided up into several platoons. You have a military monitoring platoon, which are the wireless operators who do the actual intercepting of traffic. And then you have an exploitation platoon, who are the codebreakers. The former was initially about 15 men strong, some Polish naval personnel, some Polish Air Force personnel. And there were a further 11 codebreakers in the exploitation platoon. And they were equipped with 10 wireless sets initially. The staff grows until by the summer of 1944, there are about 60 people involved in the operation.
Gosh, you're talking about summer 1944, but we know that Rejewski and Zagalski arrived in the UK the year before, in summer 1943.
Yes.
How do they fit into this story?
They arrive in August, and the Radio Intelligence Company has been established a few months earlier, so it's still in its fairly early days, but it's all set up in Boxmoor. And so it's a natural place for Rejewski and Zagalski to be sent. They arrive and they join the exploitation platoon, which was the code-breaking setup. And one of the other people who's come over with them is Lieutenant Shakno, who takes over running the exploitation platoon. So the various people who've come with Rejewski and Zagalski are folded into the operation of Boxmoor. Shakno takes over Section R, which was the Russian section. They're still doing Russian interception, as I was saying, even though after Barbarossa, the Russians are technically our allies, the Polish are still very keen to intercept their traffic, and GCSS is still keen to intercept their traffic. They're still intercepting French traffic, you know, just because people are our allies doesn't mean we stop listening to their wireless messages.
Yeah.
Within the exploitation platoon, there's a Russian section, which is Section R, and there's a Section N. And N is actually the Polish for German. It comes from Niemiecki. I probably butchered that as well, but it's the Polish word for Germans, basically. So we have Section R and Section N. And Rejewski is placed in Section N, and there's a third general section, and Zagalski is placed in that. Around this time, they also all get promoted to officers. They become lieutenants. A number of other Polish service personnel were promoted as well. And we know from the record that the five of them who'd been promoted to officers went to the White Horse pub in Boxmoor to celebrate. They had a little commissioning party.
Is that still there as well?
I think the building's still there. Whether it's still a pub or not, I'm not sure. One of the interesting things from Rejewski's point of view is that one of the huts out the back of the Arches was other ranks accommodation. If you were an officer, you were allowed to be billeted off-site in a private house. And Rejewski moved into a bungalow called Belgrave Lodge, which is nearby in Boxmoor. There are photographs of Belgrave Lodge, but since those photographs were taken, I looked on Google Maps and it's since been replaced by a more modern house. So the site is still there, but the house is gone. Amusingly, Rejewski attracted the attention of his neighbours by eating the local saffron milk cap mushrooms, which apparently in Hemel Hempstead were considered deadly poisonous and toadstools and to be avoided, but in Poland were considered something of a delicacy. So, you know,
Polish people do know mushrooms.
Imagine him coming down the road with his basket of mushrooms and his neighbours going, "Are you going to eat those?"
Why,
going,
yes.
Well, why, yes. But the other problem he had was there was a prisoner of war camp nearby, and since he was now in uniform, in Polish army uniform, because people didn't recognise a Polish uniform, people kept thinking he was an escaped prisoner of war.
Mm. That must have been quite a strange thing in Boxmoor as well. Suddenly this influx of people, there must have been masts going up, there's a prisoner of war camp, there's houses and buildings with
wandering about.
Guards at doorways and all sorts.
Exactly. So yes, he settles down in this house and every day goes into Boxmoor to the intelligence company, and they carry on working on German police traffic, particularly. Mm. Again, this is a non-Enigma system. They're using double Playfair ciphers, which he'd been breaking in France, and he carries on breaking it.
And that information that they're getting from that process of intercepting code breaking, that information is being handed to GCNCS or handed to the Polish government in exile or both?
It's being passed to SIS, to MI8 actually, who are the wireless bit of SIS, and from them to Bletchley Park.
Right.
And one of the problems initially is that the team in Boxmoor don't have any transport. And if they want to take stuff to the Rubens Hotel, for example, they have to go on the bus. And so there's a memo where they put in saying, we'd like a van.
For security purposes.
For security purposes. And they are provided with a van. It's quite weird. They build up quite a good working relationship with the Russian section in particular. John Tiltman's military section has a Russian subsection. And the Russian subsection at GCNCS at Bletchley Park has not had a great deal of success with Russian codes. So they're really grateful for the Polish support they're getting. Mm. And they basically go, right, this is great. We can just let the Poles get on with this and we'll just harvest all their product from them.
Well, duplication, particularly where one team is not actually doing that successfully, makes
exactly.
no sense.
There's no sense in duplicate. So Tiltman's quite happy to go, yes, I'll just take all their product from them. And similarly, the German police material is going to the German police people in Bletchley Park, again, the military section. The problem there, though, is there is quite a lot of duplication on German police. And so there are several documents saying, do we really need the Poles to keep doing this? But the difficulty there is that Section N and Marian Rejewski, if they don't do German police traffic, what are they going to do?
Now, as for today's taking of the Great Abbey of Monte Cassino on Monastery Hill, this was an enormously hard-won triumph for Polish troops against an enemy from whom they had suffered much. In the mountain heights through which the Poles broke to get round the back of the ruined monastery fortress, fighting had been severe in the extreme. Men fought till they dropped exhausted, or dropped killed or wounded. They had to get through appalling mountain tracks, with the Germans commanding them and pouring streams of fire upon them at every move. The Poles were counterattacked time after time when they gained a height, and there was, all the time, no way up to the hill positions except by mule and finally on foot. Always the supply, ammunition and water parties had to go up through heavy German fire. In many positions, you could by day remain alive only in a hole in the ground. To show yourself and move in daylight in these forward positions was death. I was at a Polish headquarters on the morning of the capture when the news came through. We're in the Abbey. Monastery Hill is occupied. It was a historic moment, and the drama was heightened when an officer put the good news right in front of my eyes. He handed me a small piece of paper. It's come from the monastery by one of our carrier pigeons, he said. And I looked at the crumpled scrap of paper. All that was on it was one large V for victory, drawn in pencil. And it was signed by a lieutenant of signals who had reached the Abbey.
While they're working on the German police traffic, are they also intercepting or deciphering German Enigma traffic? And do the team at Boxmoor know what the British are doing? It's certainly a question we get asked quite a lot about why weren't the Poles working on Enigma at Bletchley Park? But what did they know about what was happening at Bletchley?
Well, this is a really interesting point because they are intercepting a certain amount of Enigma because the German police do use Enigma as well as their double Playfair systems and their other hand codes. In particular, there's an Enigma key, which is codenamed TGD, slightly unusually because most Enigma keys at Bletchley Park have they're called after a fruit or an insect or something. This one was initially broken by the Polish back before the war, and TGD was the call sign, the Berlin call sign of the network. So that's its nickname. It was broken for a little while in France in 1940. How anyone broke this at all is baffling to me because what the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, the German security police, what they were actually doing was they were first enciphering the messages with a double Playfair hand cipher and then enciphering it in Enigma.
You're right. How do you decipher that when it's got multiple layers?
Well, the answer is that you couldn't decipher it with a bomb machine because you need a crib. And obviously your crib would be enciphered.
Yeah, because you're plain text once it comes out of it.
But if you go back to how the Polish techniques for breaking Enigma back in 1938, 1939, rely on preambles and repeated ground settings and things like that. So you don't need to crib it. So they could probably get a reliable Enigma decipherment, even though it was still gobbledygook, because of the way the decryption method worked. But later, obviously, once you're using a bomb, it doesn't work. So they get gobbledygook out, and then they go, we'll now break that the way you break Playfair. However, after 1940, they're pretty much stumped on this stuff. They're still intercepting it, and they're still capturing it and sharing it as part of their routine sharing with Bletchley Park, because it could still be used for traffic analysis and, you know, network analysis and all the other things you do with stuff you can't decrypt. Just because you can't read it doesn't make it useless.
So the Polish at Boxmoor are continuing to intercept and work with and hand over TGD, and do they continue to do that for the rest of the war?
They do, and also they're getting the German police Playfair. So they have stuff to do. Section N is busy with German traffic. But you can imagine Rejewski is in there going, you know, I'm not seeing any decrypted Enigma here. I wonder what's going on. And we don't know what questions he was asking or whatever. He gets settled in September, and he's apparently happy in Boxmoor for about a year. But in September 1944, the German police abandoned their double Playfair cipher system. And so that piece of work that Section N were doing disappears. And so they've almost literally got nothing to do now. They're sitting there. And I think this brought matters to a head with Rejewski, because he's been sitting there thinking, I wonder what's happening with mainstream Enigma.
His thoughts turn to what they used to work
on. And so he wrote a long memorandum to his bosses in October 1944. And this, I think, shines a really interesting light on how little Rejewski had been told about the history of Enigma since January 1940, which was the last time he had sort of proper contact with the British, when he, you know, he had dinner with Turing and they were using the Zagowski sheets and all of that. He would have been aware of the German changes in the spring of 1940 that meant that the Zagowski sheets and the other methods didn't work anymore. But there's no evidence that anyone ever told him about the invention of the British bomb, for example.
Because
there would be no reason to.
Exactly.
I mean, at that point, he was in France. I don't think that information was shared with Bertrand either, certainly in early 1940s. So he's sitting there going, I wonder what's happened with all that stuff I used to do with the British on Enigma. And he writes what is quite a grumpy memo, and I can read it to you. He says, before the war, there existed a Polish-Anglo-French cooperation in the domain of ciphers. And this, of course, is Piri and everything we know about. During which, it should be strongly stressed, the Polish side exclusively was the only one giving. That's a point of view. It would be advisable to remind the English now about the debt they owe with regard to the Polish ciphers office, to remind them that without the help of the Poles, they would not have been read a single German code message during the Norwegian and French campaigns and later. They should be requested to cooperate with the Poles with equal loyalty as the Poles cooperated with them before and now. There is no doubt that the Polish authorities have already taken measures to that end, perhaps more than once. Nevertheless, it should be once again made clear what the Polish cryptologists expect and demand of their English colleagues. So you can see there, he's quite annoyed that he feels like they did all the giving back in 1940.
He sounds angry and almost kind of aggrieved about it.
Oh, yeah. He makes a series of demands. But what's interesting about his demands is they show the fact that he knows nothing about how big Enigma has become at Bletchley Park. He says, first of all, they should be requested to return the German Enigma ciphering machine that the Poles once presented to them. This is the machine, famously, that was delivered at Victoria Station back in 1939. The Polish cryptologists need the Enigma, for the archives at least, if not for other purposes. It is proper for those who have rebuilt the machine that they should possess at least one model. And he goes on, then they should be urged to share their experience gained in the last 5 years in the domain of German ciphers, preferably by way of a direct contact of interested Polish and English cryptologists.
You're right. It seems that he's assuming it's still quite a small operation.
Yes. He's seeing it in the terms of 1940, when GC&CS was a couple of hundred people. He could meet with Turing over dinner. You know, it was all what we call the cottage industry phase of Enigma breaking.
But this is October 1944. Can you tell us what it looked like then?
By then, Bletchley Park is 7,000 to 8,000 people strong. There are already probably 150 bomb machines running. Stanmore is open. Eastcote is open.
24-hour shift working.
24-hour shift work. 1,500 wrens. You know, Enigma is now an industry. It's not a dozen men in an office, which he thinks it still is. I infer that he thinks it still is. In the same way that the Germans don't appreciate just the industrial scale of the effort, it doesn't occur to Rejewski either. He still thinks it's some men in a room. The Polish Second Bureau take up Rejewski's cause, and here again, Biffy Dunderdale steps in, and a letter was written to Dunderdale by Rievsky's bosses, reiterating Rievsky's demands, if you like. And again, I can read the memo. It says, "Your help is necessary in the following issues. One, regularly providing 2nd Lieutenant Rievsky in the Arches, Felden, Boxmoor, with copies of all German intercept material in unbroken form received by the British unit deciphering German ciphers."
Wow.
And if you consider that that's thousands of Enigma messages every day, both military and naval, as well as, you know, intelligence service. You know, it's like in 1941 when Churchill said, "Send me everything." In 1941, Churchill, it was already impossible because the scale of the operation was just so epic. Point two, returning to us the German ciphering machine Enigma, which was given to the British staff the other day. Well, one the other day, it was 4 years before. But And three, providing us with current experience of British cryptologists in the German branch through the working level contacts of 2nd Lieutenant Rievsky and 2nd Lieutenant Zygalski with respective British specialists. Again, it's this idea that two Polish codebreakers in a team of a dozen Polish codebreakers will make any difference to the factory that is Ultra. You know? And I'm not trying to diminish their importance in any way by saying this. It's simply that times have moved on and they have not been part of that process. And it's not their fault. They don't know. No one has told them. And Rievsky is here saying, "Please tell me. I want to contribute. I want to get back in the game. I think I have something useful to do."
But at that point, he's not going to be read into this.
He's not going to be read in at that point. No, he's surplus to requirements now. In the spring of 1944, the contrast is really striking between the Radio Intelligence Company, where we're talking about a suburban house with 60 Polish wireless operators and codebreakers in it, and the intelligence factory that is GCNCS, which is 7,000 people, which is producing intelligence to build up for D-Day, is supporting the, as Thomas talked about previously, supporting the bombing campaign over Europe, breaking Japanese codes. It's at the peak of its powers, in a sense. We think of that point in the war as when Bletchley Park is really firing on all cylinders. And you're not comparing like with like in any meaningful way, really.
No. But the Polish organisation at Boxmoor is still incredibly valuable in the work that they were doing.
They're
on
a tiny cog in the machine, but they're a very important cog in the sense that they're still doing this Russian work that Tiltman still wants.
With skills that weren't at GCNCS.
Skills that weren't at GCNCS, yes. So they're not useless by any sense. Section R, the guys that are doing Russian, are still very much valued by Tiltman. It's unfortunate that Rievsky and Section N, the German section, have been kind of overtaken by events at this point.
And this is why when we speak about Rievsky and Zygalski, their contribution tends to be the more well-known bit is right at the start of the war. And so therefore their later work, because much of it isn't involved with the slightly more, let's say, you know, thrilling Enigma story, it tends to be more overlooked or less well-known.
And there is no doubt, this is something that people argue about, I'm happy to put myself on the record, is I don't think there is a Turing Welshman bomb without a Polish bomber.
Yeah.
There is a definite path that you can follow from Rievsky, Zygalski and Rozycki in Poznan to the bomber, to the bomb, to British Enigma codebreaking. We're not trying to diminish that in any way with what we're saying now. It's simply that by 1944, Rievsky, Zygalski and Rozycki's work on Enigma is over.
The meeting at war-torn Malta is only preliminary to the final meeting with Marshal Stalin. The Mediterranean Conference of the Allied Military Leaders is held within the stately walls of Montgomery House. Here starts a series of talks that will profoundly influence the diplomatic and political future of the world. Field Marshal Alexander of the Mediterranean Theater and General Brehon Somerville and Admiral King attend. But the meeting really gets down to business at Yalta, former Crimean summer capital of the Tsars. Anthony Eden, Foreign Commissar Molotov, and Secretary Stettinius are on hand to greet England's Prime Minister. Hoping to solve intricate problems of war and peace, President Roosevelt reaches the Yalta meeting, accompanied by his daughter, Mrs. Anna Boniker. These are Army Signal Corps pictures of an historic world meeting that will shape the destiny of future generations. The summer palace of Tsar Nicholas II is the setting for Russia's welcome. The conference is to seal Hitler's fate and establish lasting peace and is attended by presidential advisor Harry Hopkins with Mr. Eden. The host arrives, Joseph Stalin, chairman of the Council of People's Commissars of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Not since the Tehran Conference 14 months ago have the three top executives of Allied strategy and diplomacy met. Meantime, the results of that first meeting were bearing fruit on Germany's eastern and western borders.
How was this resolved then? How does this story end, David?
Unfortunately for Rejewski, his complaints come at a point when questions are being asked about Polish wireless activity and the Polish government in exile more generally. Because even before D-Day, in the spring of 1944, there were discussions ongoing with the Soviets and with Stalin about what post-war Europe would look like. And Churchill and Roosevelt were very keen to keep the alliance solid and keep the Soviets on board until the war was over. And it became clear that the Polish government in exile had a completely different view of what post-war Poland would look like to what the British government or the Soviet government or the American government had. They were essentially working on the assumption that when the Allies won the war, Poland would be reinstated to its pre-war boundaries. You know, it would get back the bit of Germany that it had had pre-war. The Russians would be put back to their original pre-war frontiers and everything else. But it was clear to the Western Allies that Stalin had no plans to give up. He had no interest in an independent Poland. He wanted Poland to be as small as possible and basically a puppet of the Soviet Union. So the British government basically had a choice. Do we go with Stalin's version of post-war Poland, or do we go with the Polish government in exile's version? And obviously Stalin's version is going to win, because in the great world of realpolitik, the Russians are more important. And so questions started to be asked about what the Polish government in exile was doing in Poland, what the Polish resistance was doing. And it became clear that Polish resistance and Polish preparations for their secret army and everything else were as much anti-Soviet as they were anti-Nazi. And so SOE has been supporting Polish clandestine operations, but they are told, you know, hang on a minute, we need to start reining in Polish clandestine activity because we don't want them to interrupt the seamless transition into a Soviet-controlled post-war Poland, basically. Mm. And as a result, a spotlight starts to shine on all of the activities that the Polish government in exile are doing to do with wireless. And obviously the focus is on clandestine traffic to Poland, but Boxmoor and Felden are going to fall under that spotlight as well.
Mm, yeah.
And support starts to dwindle away. And equally, the only thing they're really doing for Bletchley Park at that point is Russian, which is something that increasingly the British aren't interested in anymore. Well, not in that way. They will be building up their anti-Russian activity in 1945.
Yeah.
That's sort of a separate story, but they don't want it done by the Poles is the point. So Rejewski isn't going to get anywhere with trying to, you know, big up the part of the radio intelligence company at that point. The British are much more interested in quietly getting rid of the radio intelligence company. Mm. And indeed, on the 5th of July, 1945, the British government formally recognises the new government in Poland, in, quote, liberated Poland, which is a Soviet puppet government in all but name.
This is quite a contentious part of history as well.
Oh, and yes.
There's obviously accusations that, you know, Britain behaved shabbily or, you know, betrayed in some cases.
Yes,
and the Polish cause.
It's a tragic story because famously Stalin makes sure that the Soviet forces, who are within a few miles of Warsaw, hold back until the Warsaw Uprising has collapsed before they kick the Germans out of Warsaw. And the Polish Airborne Brigade, there was talk of parachute support to the uprising and all these kinds of things, but ultimately the Russians are left to do what the Russians want to do. And the radio intelligence company is a victim of that much wider political picture. And in September 1945, there's a document which survives, which describes, it's a rather unfortunate term, the liquidation of the radio intelligence company. They don't mean liquidation quite how Stalin would have meant liquidation, mm-hmm. but they shut the organization down. And the same document lists 9 personnel from the radio intelligence company who will be sent to Scotland, because the Polish armed forces, Polish army units are mostly based in Scotland and they have training centres up there where they're still nominally doing military stuff, even though the war is finished. And the list of people going there includes Marian Rejewski, it includes Henryk Zgalski, it also includes Sylvester Paluth. Interestingly, it also includes a gentleman called Ferdinand Vanka, who we have recently encountered because he is still with us.
He is
at the age of 100 and something.
Yeah, as of recording this podcast, he's a fabulous chap.
He's been able to help me quite a lot with his story, actually, in explaining some aspects of it. And although they went to Scotland, both Zgalski and Rejewski were formally demobbed and discharged from the Polish forces at the end of 1946. And so their code-breaking story comes to an end at that point. Rejewski went back to Poland shortly after, but Henryk Zgalski stayed in the UK. He was by that time already in a relationship with a British woman called Bertha Blofield, who lived in Boxmoor. She had been already married, but her husband died in 1947, and she stayed with Zagalski until he died in 1978. He lived out the rest of his life in the UK, and we're still in touch with some members of the family, aren't we?
Yes, and there's so much more that I wish we could talk about. I hope very soon in another episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, we can cover yet more Polish stories and hear from more people connected to telling this story. I think it is really important that we keep talking about it, and not just the very early days of the incredible Enigma breaks, but also all the way through, I think. And some of it's uncomfortable and some of it is tragic, but it is really, really important to talk about it. I'd like to steer our listeners, if they are on YouTube, to the Enigma Cipher Center's YouTube channel, their CS Enigma, which is Centrum Szyfrów Enigma. They have an interview with Ferdinand Vanka in English with Polish subtitles on that channel. So if you would like to hear some of this story from the words of somebody that was there, we really recommend you go and take a look at that.
I was just going to say that although he stayed in the UK, it's perhaps sad that Zagalski died in 1978, because that was exactly the point when the Enigma story was starting to emerge.
Yes.
Had he lived another couple of years, he might have had his big questions answered.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.